welcome. It's KVC Arts, arts and entertainment, as well as the people and places providing it. I'm David Fleming. Tonight we'll hear from Begoña Echeverria, talking about, among many other projects, a song written for her aunt, who died in late March from complications due to the coronavirus. That's coming up later in the program. We're starting with a recent book, a book filled with advice on retirement, how to invest, or at least how to know if you have the right or wrong investment counselor. Emmanuel Rogers has more.
Joining us today is Teresa Ghilarducci, author of the new book, How to Retire with Enough Money and How to Know What Enough Is. Thank you for joining us today, Teresa.
Thank you.
Teresa, before we get started about how to retire with enough money, would you mind sharing with our audience a little bit about you and also where they can find more about your books and what you do?
So my book is called How to Retire with Enough Money. It's a how-to guide, but I'm not really a how-to person. I'm an academic. I'm a professor of economics. I also am a trustee of several multi-million dollar pension funds. So I got all the information that's in the book from my position as an academic economist and as a practical professional money manager. I have no connection to any financial firm at all. I get no money from any bankers. So I'm in a really, I think, a pretty good position to give advice that is commonplace and sort of not conflicted. Like, I don't need money from this book or from any financial sector.
All right. Well, now, before we talk about how to retire with enough money, I want to ask you something about your preceding book, When I'm 64, The Plot Against Pensions and the Plan to Save Them.
That's the reason I wrote How to Retire with Enough Money, because there is a plot against pensions. We have a poorly designed system, and I wrote this book, How to Retire with Enough Money, to help people navigate themselves through a really bad system. So the plot against pensions is the do-it-yourself pension system, where you're supposed to know how much money to save, where to invest it, and how to draw it out so that it lasts the rest of your life. It's almost impossible, as it would be for us to have to pull our own teeth or do our own electric wiring.
Oh, yes.
It's a really disaster, like when I try to paint my house is a disaster because I'm not a professional painter. So it's really important for people to realize that most of the advice that they get is conflicted advice.
Yes.
So one of my points is the way that you make your money grow in this kind of environment is to make sure that your fees are the lowest possible fees. And that means to invest in index funds and to ignore the siren call of daily stock market changes or to try to decide which company is a good company or not. Just invest in index funds and a broad array of stocks.
Now, you're talking mainly about things like fiduciary investing, right?
Yeah, so I can talk to 100 people and only one will say the word fiduciary, and you're the one. So fiduciary is what you want out of your advisor, and most people don't have fiduciaries. Fiduciaries means that they act professionally only for your interests, not their own.
Right.
So if you're in a traditional pension plan and to some extent in a 401k, your managers have a fiduciary responsibility. Though in the 401ks, they kind of shave this responsibility and they're getting sued all the time. But the fees are supposed to be low and the investments are supposed to be the lowest after fee rate of return at the lowest risk for your pension fund. And most people don't have that protection, especially if they take their 401k and put it in an IRA. So this little book that I wrote helps people be their own trustee, you know, be their own fiduciary, and to make sure that the decision that people make on their behalf is only in their interest.
Now, I know because I've sat and listened to an investment counselor before, and I never heard him ask me about the things that would do best for me, just what the returns were and not much about the fees.
Yes.
So he never himself mentioned fiduciary, and I understand why. But one of the most—
Did you fire him?
Yes, I did.
Good.
I got up
Good.
And walked away.
Good.
One of the most important things you spoke about, and we just touched on it, is to get rid of your guy. Because we've all heard people say,
Yes. Yeah,
I have a guy over here. How do we know if we have the right financial help? And how do we find the best for ourselves in such a profit-driven environment?
So on page 77 of my book, and this book is really small, so
yes,
each page is like a half a page. I have 6 critical questions to ask your guy, and it's kind of one of those trick tests sometimes are evil enough to give my students. Every implicit advisor cannot give you a satisfactory answer to 6 of these questions. So if they can't answer or won't answer any of these questions, you're supposed to run. And most people will actually move away from their guy when they get to question 3.
Okay.
So one question that I would ask is, hey, do you make any money off of the decisions I make here today? And if they are truthful, the non-fee-for-service financial advisor will say, yes, if you buy this fund, I will get a kickback. That's an honest answer.
Okay.
So the only way you can be sure is if you have a fee-only financial advisor.
Now, how do we know when we have the right one and we don't run away from that?
So if you have a good financial advisor, they're going to take into account not only your preferences for risk and your feelings about return, but they're going to take into account your whole portfolio. They're going to ask you whether or not you own your house or how much you owe on the house.
Mm-hmm.
They're going to ask you about your expected family obligations. It's going to be uncomfortable. You know, they'll ask you uncomfortable questions. Like if you have a kid that you just sort of know is going to always ask you for money and you feel like you could afford it, then they're going to budget that. If you say, I have a kid who's going to ask me for $20,000 a year and you can't afford it, that person will tell you. So you might be only... honest advisor should make you feel a little uncomfortable. Free ones that are trying to sell you something, it's always happy talk.
Right.
So that's one way to look. They're going to take into account, just to summarize, your whole portfolio and your whole life, not just your financial assets.
Thank you so much. You also mentioned that the book is a really short book. It's 116 pages of great information. And I wanted to ask you, why did you keep it short, and who is the target audience?
Yeah, you know, I kept it short because I really can't stand all the other books that are out there that are kind of display behavior. You know, that all those other books try to get the authority over the reader by having a lot of sort of charts and calculations, treating the reader as if they should be kind of a robot with an Excel spreadsheet. And humans aren't built that way. They don't roll that way. And so I wrote this book after having conversations with my friends at dinner parties, you know, over car rides, that I know what kind of questions people really have and what level of detail they need to have. And so it turns out if you're not trying to show off or uh-huh. make people feel ashamed and they should listen to you as an expert, it's easy to write a short book.
And this book is written well. I know I'm going to use it personally. Now, I wanted to ask, what are some of the basic strategies to having enough money to live on in retirement?
Yeah, so there's basically 2 strategies. One is that you have to accumulate enough, and the other is that you have to invest it well. So the first thing you do to accumulate is to save early, save often, save the maximum in your 401k and don't touch it. That also means, though, not getting into debt. I don't just talk about retirement accounts. I really talk about what everybody really knows is that a credit card should be paid off every month and that you should pay off your mortgage as soon as you can.
Right.
In fact, don't get a mortgage that's longer than 15 years and actually try to cut that amount in half. That means you're going to buy a smaller house than your broker says you should have or everybody around you says you deserve to have,
mm-hmm.
but you know better. You want to be on the side of the interest rate where you collect interest. You don't want to be on the side of the interest rate where you're paying interest. The same thing goes with any consumer durable, like a car or anything else. You do not want to pay interest on a product that depreciates as soon as you use it. So stay debt-free. You accumulate wealth that way and accumulate by saving a little bit after every paycheck. And then investing well means to have a diversified index portfolio that you do not pay fees on. You know, rate of return are so low now and the fees are so high, a goodly amount of people that earn no return at all or negative return. The fees are eating into their principal.
Why is that allowed to happen?
They're strong lobbyists in the retail investing world, and they have a lot of power. For decades, they've been able to lobby Congress using your money, telling Congress that 401k and IRA participants should not know what their fees are. So we're still fighting the fee transparency issue. and they get their lobbying money from their revenue from operations, which is your high fee. I find that striking, you know, in terms of conflict. And the losers of all this are so diffuse. You know, there's so many of us that lose every month without knowing it, that we haven't organized. So I guess my book here is a kind of a call to action, not only a call to action to like, free yourself from this exploitative behavior, but really to get everybody on the same page so that we could actually pass some legislation that can protect consumers.
Okay, now with that, one of the quotes I put here in our script is, if you're not worried, you probably don't understand the situation. Teresa, what is the situation for most economically, and how did it become so confusing to us? And since you brought that up, what can we do to work together to change it?
Yeah, there's a couple of reasons. One is that if you think you're going to be okay, you've been listening to too much happy talk from advisors who say, put the authority in my hands, follow me, and I'll do you well. So since they have a buddy, they think that they're doing well.
Right.
So you don't understand the situation if you think that things are on track. The other reason why you might not understand the situation is because you don't want to. Psychologically, it is very hard to admit that your financial future is at risk, that you may not have the kind of bargaining power you want, and I'm using the word loosely, leave a job you don't like, or even, you know, God forbid, a relationship or a marriage you don't like, you know, because you're trapped financially. That is just a horrible position to be in for any kind of relationship, whether it's a work or personal relationship.
Right.
And so a lot of people just decide everything will be fine, kind of what I call a faith-based, you know, retirement plan. That's not a reality-based retirement plan. I think if people cut back on their spending in order to secure their financial future, that will actually not make them feel deprived, but enriched. One of the advice I have is to kind of fall in love with the stuff that you have. Take your shoes and your golf clubs, you know, out for a date. Clean your car. Don't buy another one. All these things really help secure your financial future.
This is really great information. What is a comfortable nest egg for most
people? What's comfortable is if you're making about $50,000 per year. I chose that because that's the median household income. Is if you have 8 times your salary when you retire. And that's a lot. That's $400,000. People now aren't even close. But if you have your home paid off and that home is, you know, affordable in terms of taxes and maintenance, you're in pretty good shape. That means not that you have to retire, but that you have a lot of choices about what kind of work you want to do if you have enough to live on. Imagine your life just brightening up if you realize, oh, I could quit my job, take some time to find another one, or not get another one, and I'd be fine. Everyone deserves that, not just rich people.
Right.
And when we had our old pension system, most people had that situation, and I don't want people to lose that.
And I remember that. But sadly, our time has come to an end, and I've been enjoying this so much. Will you please tell our listeners once again where they can find out more about your books and the info that you share online?
Yeah, sure. My name is Teresa, and my last name is Gilarducci, which is pretty much a long name. So if you just Google Teresa and how to retire with enough money, you'll find my book. You'll find my website, TeresaGilarducci.org. You'll find book reviews. Find Fortune Magazine, Forbes, Time Magazine, New York Times, you know, have said about me. And I think people will start, you know, getting control of their lives and just feel a lot better and not be preyed upon.
Yeah. I want to thank you for being in that forefront of that fight, because I know you also talk with our nation's leaders and all, and trying to help with GRAs and all these things that we really don't have a grasp on. But someone's out there fighting. Thank you so much.
Hey, I really appreciate that, because I don't really do anything else, and I'm kind of a one-note person, but thank you.
You're welcome. You have a great note going, by the way. Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
That was Emmanuel Rogers in conversation with Teresa Gilarducci. Find her books, essays, and more at TeresaGilarducci.com. Teresa, T-E-R-E-S-A, G-H-I-L-A-R-D-U-C-C-I.org. You're listening to KVC Arts on 91.9 KVCR. I'm David Fleming. We are streaming live at KVCRnews.org. Let's go now to Begonia Echeverria. Later, we'll hear about a song written for her aunt, who died from complications due to the coronavirus in late March. We'll hear about some of her other projects as well, including her book, Hammer of Witches, an historical novel with strong parallels to the Salem witch trials, except across the ocean and about 80 years earlier.
The Hammer of Witches is based on the 1610 burning of Basque, in parentheses, witches in Logroño, Spain. And people might know Logroño because it's the capital of La Rioja with the wine. Okay. My family is from the region. It's called Bastan, the Valley of Bastan, where most of the witches, again, in quotation marks, were taken from that valley. So I had a vague sense that something had happened, but didn't know very much about it. And there are a lot of songs in Basque about witches, but the witches aren't based on the historical story. They're sort of based on Basque mythology and folklore. And they, you know, they like to have a good time, and they're kind of whimsical, and they play tricks on people, but they're not sort of the devil-worshipping cannibalistic witches that in the historical case were accused of being. So I was doing some recovery research for my day job as a professor at UC Riverside, and looking at changes in the language, Zenoka in particular, which I'm sure we'll talk about. And so all the documents are all together. And so there were a lot of references in when I was looking at song or other kinds of documents about the witches. And it's very well documented. So in Pamplona, there's an archive that has actual list, the ledger of people who were burned at the stake or who were reconciled with the church. And so I thought, well, this is sort of an interesting story, and it was so well documented, so I decided to sort of write a story about it, and so that's what Hammer of Witches ended up being. So it follows, in some ways, closely the timeline of the actual case, but I simplified it in some ways, so there's fewer witches that get burned at the stake, and there's fewer inquisitors, and there are all these different kinds of inquisitors that had different roles, but I sort of had like two of them in the novel. And I include some songs in there, from some traditional songs, a few songs that I wrote, some folk tales, I sprinkle them in, and then I also had a storyline, which as far as I know was not historical, about some people who were persecuted for being French Protestants, or they're called Huguenots. So I sort of mixed that all together, and it ends up being sort of a story about religious intolerance and sort of what happens to an area that's on the border because it's between France and Spain when there's political instability and religious conflict and sort of who the victims end up being.
Nice. And while it's not historical per se, it is based within history. And you did receive an award for this, the Historical Novel Society's Editor's Choice. That was in 2015.
That's right. Yeah. I was very happy to see that. Yes. Yeah, to get that. Yes.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, where can people find this book?
I think the easiest place actually is on Amazon. It is still available through the Center for Basque Studies based at the University of Nevada, Reno. But they'll hate me for saying this. But the easier way to get it is through Amazon. Yeah.
While we're at it, do you have a website? Are you a tweeter? Where all can people find you and follow your work?
I am so not on social media. I'm very old school, so I don't have a website. I'm not on Twitter. Okay. I'm not on Facebook, but I'm easy to find. So I'm the only Begonia Echeverria, only Begonia at UC Riverside, and so I have a faculty profile page so people can get a hold of me that way. And I have another way of getting a hold of me is through the website for my singing group, NOCA.
Okay, well, I couldn't have written a better segue. You've been on KVC Arts in the past talking about the music group NOCA. That's N-O-K-A. Tell us a bit about NOCA, please.
Okay, well, that website is iLoveNOCA.com.
Yeah, nice.
And again, it's spelled N-O-K-A. And NOCA is a second-person pronoun, sort of like two in Spanish, okay. So that it's an informal form of address. We're speaking to one person, but it's to a person who is female. So this is before the days where they had identified as female or not, so when there's binary world. So, so if you're speaking to one girl or one woman, you would use this form. It's called NOCA. And there's an equivalent form called TOCA, which is to speak to one boy or one man. The TOCA form still has a lively place in the culture, so it's used by singers and by athletes and public sphere and a ton in song. And the NOCA form is dying, essentially. So this group that I'm a part of called NOCA with two other people, Andrea Bedart and Kelly Peterson, the other two singers, we've been singing together for over 20 years now, and we're thinking of what's a good name for our group. And we decide on this name because it's a sort of the perfect marker of what we're trying to do, which is trying to sing songs from a female perspective or uncover songs that are either addressed to women or about women, in some cases written by women, that are not normally sung. So we all grew up in the Basque community of Chino, and there's still a big tradition of singing songs around the table at dinner, after any meal, really. And the songs that we normally sing are very rarely any songs that are about women who are the protagonists. And I actually have a book coming out in the fall that's about the history of NOCA.
You'll love
this title.
Nice.
It's called Witches, in quotation marks, Witches and Wily Women, : Saving NOCA Through Basque Folklore and Song. Witches and Wily Women, www. And what it is, it's a social history of the NOCA form. So I talk about why, sort of what it is, the sociolinguistic place it has in the culture, also a little bit of the history of the Basque language itself.
Okay.
And among the things that are interesting about the Basque language is that it's an endangered language.
Yes.
It's also a language isolate, so it's not related to any other language in the world. So that's coming out in the fall, and I feel very lucky that book also, my research plays hand in hand with the music that I've been involved with singing with this group. And so it's been really fun. We have, we're looking at another CD, which we were recording last summer, and then sort of we've kind of been slowed down a little bit by COVID. So there's been a delay, but we hope to have some more songs out relatively soon that are through Noka.
Keep me in the loop with your book, too, and we'll get you on talking about that as well when it's available as well.
Well, if you insist, I would love that.
I have to ask, since you are an academic, and I will also say that is such a very academic title, as if you're presenting at a conference. There's always that colon, if you know what I'm saying. There's the first part of the title, colon, here's the rest. And that's
right.
I see this a lot. But yes, we will definitely have you back when this book is available. And will it be available for the public, or is this going to be what the students get?
It will be through the same publisher, and so Center for Basque Studies, and also so we'll have a link to Amazon, I'm thinking. The website is UNR, as in Reno, .edu/Basque, BASQUE /studies.
Nice. I'm David Fleming in conversation with Begonia H. Varia. You're listening to KVCR. It's on 91.9 KVCR, streaming live at kvcrnews.org. Find many past KVCR programs via podcast through iTunes, NPR1, Spotify, and Google Play. And most past shows are kvcrnews.org/arts. Begonia, you also have a docudrama, Picasso Presents Guernica.
Yes, there's a Basque pronunciation and spelling of the word, and then there's the Spanish one. So the Basque pronunciation of the town is Guernica. So the play is called Picasso Presents Guernica, and when I use that spelling and that pronunciation, so G-E-R-N-I-K-A, it's referring to the town, which was the first town decimated by aerial bombing, and the victims were primarily civilians. So this was April 26, 1937, in the middle of the Spanish Civil War. And Francisco Franco sort of buddied up with Hitler, and he had these new bombs he wanted to try out. And Hitler said, go ahead, try it on this. And that town, Guernica, is sort of the sacred center of the Basque country. So it was a very kind of deliberate choice. And so what happened in the historical case was that there was this bombing. It was completely surprising because it hadn't happened before. And parents, understandably, got very scared. And so many of them sent their children off. This predated kinder transport by a few years. So they sent their children someplace else because they were wondering, as if this is going to keep happening. I want to keep my kids safe. So they sent their kids off to countries that were allies with the democratically elected government, which was against Franco. Franco was trying to bring that down, and he ended up succeeding. So I met a Basque woman. Well, let me see. I met a British woman when I was living in the Basque country almost 30 years ago, and her father was one of these kids. So she was of Basque descent on her father's side, and she said that her father was sent with his brother by their mother as children to England, you know, to flee the bombing. And then when World War II started, and there was this sort of this pressure, and there were some people in England who still wanted to help the children, but they're also like, you know, we have our own kids. We have British children to worry about. And so there was this pressure by some to send the kids back that could go back. And so the mother of these two children calls for one of their brothers back, but not the other one. The friend that I had was the daughter of the one that was left behind, and he had no idea why the mother didn't ask for him. You know, so he died not knowing why. And so that's all I know of that story. But about probably close to 10 years now, that sort of seemed to me to be a good seed for a story, and it sort of felt like a play to me. It didn't feel like a novel for some reason. So the play, Picasso Presents Guernica, is part of it is Picasso explaining the painting, which I think is normally pronounced Guernica, which is the Spanish, and that's that very famous painting in Madrid. And so it's sort of, he tells a story both of the painting, sort of what it means and why he made it, and sort of how it traveled around the world. So he refused to have it shown in Spain so long as Franco was alive, or so long as Spain was not democratic. But Picasso died in 1973, and Franco died 2 years later. So he didn't live long enough to see that happen. So in the meantime, the painting was sent all over the world and ended up being in New York for many decades. So part of it is him telling the story of Guernica, the painting, and what it means, and anti-war messages and how they've been taken up or not historically. And the other part of the story is based loosely, again, on my friend's story. So I make the bombing happens, and then the father dies, and the mother has a daughter and a son, and sends them both to England, only asks for one of them back. And the story is following sort of the one that was left behind and the one that was sent back, and intersperses it with archival footage and film reels and art that relates to that story. So I had a stage reading last May at Chinook Community Theater, and I had some others planned that have been delayed. But it looks like this is far enough away. I have another scheduled stage reading actually at Santa Monica Playhouse for their benefit series next November. It's slated for November 20, which it will be the 40th anniversary of Franco's death. So that was why I picked that date.
Yeah.
But that's assuming that by next November that things are okay enough that we can have the stage reading. So I had that planned. I had a couple other things that were in the works. I had a reading that was scheduled in Cal State Bakersfield this May, but I had to cancel that because of what was going on. So working with some colleagues again at UCR to hopefully bring it to life in other forms, perhaps as a documentary, another kind of a workshop that will use it as sort of a basis of talking about human rights issues now.
Yes.
So it kind of is morphing into in interesting directions, I think.
Absolutely. This is going to be something that people would find timely, I think, in any time that it's around, any time that there's strife between
Unfortunately,
people.
Unfortunately. I mean, it's similar. I mean, it's sort of this time of very heightened political rhetoric and what happens in those cases and what do we do with the most vulnerable and what do we do with refugees and all that. And another nice byproduct of that was that I also wrote a song at the end in Basque that explains why the mother made the choice she did in terms of which child she left behind. And I wrote the words, and I collaborated with a new musician and composer. Her name is Belinda Tom, T-H-O-M. And she wrote a beautiful tune for the words. And so I've been working with her on some songs, too, where and some of them are my lyrics and some of them are traditional songs. And she's played many instruments that'll be on the ukulele, some of the guitar.
Nice.
And so that's sort of going in its own directions as well.
Well, cool. Way cool. Look forward to seeing some of this stuff appear through NOCA here and there. And the nice thing about seeing a NOCA performance is that in between the songs, there's an explanation. This is a folk song. This is the story of this one, et cetera. So I hope to see this come forward.
Yeah, thank you for saying that. I sort of assume that, well, very often the audience is not very familiar with Basque audiences are, but it's really a lot of Basque audiences too won't necessarily know the history of the language.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people even who like the songs won't know these particular songs. Some of them are very old. And then with American audiences, I think a lot of people don't know where the Basque Country is. And so I sort of enjoy explaining all of that and sort of pointing to on a map. And people have heard about some things about it, but just sort of filling out the picture that people might have about it.
Yeah, nice. One more thing before we get to the song that you wrote quite recently under very sad circumstance. I do want to hear about also, you're workshopping a second historical novel, something called Apparitions.
And yes, this you are. You pay good attention. Yes, I did.
Well, yeah, so this is a really cool thing. Yeah, the supposed appearance of the Virgin Mary to Basque children.
Yeah, right. In 1931. This is similar in many ways to the historical context for the Hammer of Witches. So it's sort of similar in that it's more or less in the same place and it's in the border and this is a time of political conflict. I mean, it's right around the beginning of the very short-lived democracy that preceded Franco. So there are people who, you know, for democracy, other people who are afraid of democracy, who see some of the people who are for democracy as very anti-church and they love the church. And there's just a lot of political instability and goings on. And it's, again, right on the border. And so you had these children, and this is similar to the historical case with the supposed witch sightings, is that you have children who say that they see something and then sort of the authority structures are completely reversed. And so, you know, tens of thousands of people would go to these mountain sites to see these children. And the initial people who supposedly saw the Virgin Mary were children, and then other people said they saw them too, and some of them were adults. But the ones that sort of became famous were children. And they would go to meet platforms for them, and they would watch them in having visions. And this is, again, very well documented. And there were some songs also in Basque newspapers that talked about them, and some of them on the believing side and some on the disbelieving side or unbelieving side. So it was sort of, is it happening? Is it not happening? Is it happening? Is it not happening? And then what ended up happening was that there were some people who were hoping that it would be like a lure in the Basque Country and that the Catholic Church would verify it as an authentic apparition site and allow for a cathedral to be built there and sort of some people had those planned. And then instead what happened was that the people there were persecuted and some of the powers that be in the, so Franco persecuted some of the people who were supposedly seeing the Virgin Mary and their followers. And then an influential bishop shut it down and said, it's fake. You know, I forbid you to ever talk about this again. Just like in the Hammer of Witches, where in the historical case, what ended up happening was that there was an inquisitor who was always kind of skeptical, but he sort of always was outvoted. When he came back to investigate, he found out that the witnesses were coerced or bribed in some cases to say that they saw what they saw. So this bishop did the same thing and pretty much shut it down by saying, you know, shut up about it already. And then it sort of disappeared. And then there was an anthropology of religion, UC Santa Barbara, named William Christian, who was doing research in the Basque Country and talked to people who were now in their 80s, 70s, 80s, who were around at that time. Mm. And they hadn't told anybody. I mean, some of them had worshipped sort of underground for decades because they really believed that these apparitions were real. And they didn't tell anybody because they were persecuted. It was still under Franco and all of that. I was surprised. Like, how come I don't know about this?
Yeah.
And I actually went and I visited. You can go even now to the town and you can still find it. And we went to the town and I just asked somebody there, you know, hey, where's the, pretty much, hey, excuse me, where's the apparition site? Oh, and then he pointed away and we went up to this hill and you still little people believe pictures and there's a picture of the Virgin Mary. And so I think there's still some people who think something happened there. So apparitions is based very loosely on that. I mean, I sort of gave myself permission on this one to sort of see where the story takes me. But I have elements of it that are from the perspective of a child who sees the Virgin Mary. And then I have some that are people who don't believe her and other people who do believe her. And so I'm almost done with the first draft, and then I'll be hopefully getting that ready for publication in the next year or so.
Wow. Yeah. Well, this is, again, another one to look forward to. We're going to get you in probably, thanks. I guess, maybe quarterly thanks. Or something. So.
It'll motivate me to actually get these things done. Rent off workshopping them up for a while.
Nice.
You're listening to KVC Arts on 91.9 KVCR. I'm David Fleming. We are streaming live at kvcrnews.org. Let's go now back to Begonia Echevarria. She sings in a Basque language folk group and recently wrote a song for her aunt, who died in late March from complications due to the coronavirus. We'll hear about the song in a little over 2 minutes, but first, the song in its entirety.
Okay, thank you.
Coronavirusa ituri zaiku itxai isila bezala. Gure etxeta suko deneta guo hartu gabe sartu da. Gure osasun eta ageman lapurtzera teldu dea. Elkartasuna indartu eta virus hau gaindituko da. Egin behar duguna, naizta parte izan, elkar lagunduta maitatu, amodioak deurua hiltzen baitu. Coronavirusa iturri zaiku senideak ebastera. Adiskidea ihortzi dugu adi horrik ezeranak. Azken agurra egiazkoa ez da hilo binegote. Birua baita elkar artikoa, zeru lurak dena lutzen. Egin behar duguna, naizta parte izan, elkar lagunduta maitatu, amodioak deurua hiltzen baitu. Egin behar duguna, naizta parte lagunduta maitatu, amodioak deurua hiltzen baitu. Elkar lagunduta maitatu, amodioak deurua hiltzen baitu.
Coronavirus Biru, The Thread of Coronavirus, written by Begonia Echevarria. And before we go further, Begonia, please, could you read the lyrics in English, please?
Coronavirus came to us like a silent devil. Into our homes and every corner it entered without our noticing. Our health and our relationships, did it come to take them from us? If we stay strong with one another, this virus will be defeated. And then the refrain is, what we must do, even though we are separated, is help and love one another, for love kills the devil. Coronavirus came to us to steal our families. We buried our friend without saying goodbye. But the genuine farewell does not stay in the grave, for the thread between us is what ties heaven and earth. What we must do, even as we are separated, is help and love one another, for love kills the devil.
Beautiful. Wow. Thank you very much for reading about this. Again, this was written for your aunt who passed away due to the coronavirus March 31st of 2020. Tell me about your aunt for whom this was written.
Yeah, she was really wonderful. So she was the sixth child of seven. So she was the only aunt I had left there. And she was sort of the matriarch of the traditional, again, in quotation marks, multi-generational home in the Basque Country. So my parents are from the mountains, really close to the French border, and they have farms there. Her husband died a while ago, so she was there, and one of her sons inherited the farm, and then he lives there with his wife and their two sons who all work on the farm or related businesses. So, you know, she had grown up sort of this way her whole life. She was in my father's house first, her family home, and then she got married and then moved to this other house, which is not that far in the mountains also. And she was very hardworking. She was a great hostess. One of my favorite stories is when I was living there for a summer to work on my honors project when I was in college, I would hop from one house to the other. And so I'm not a picky eater, I guess. So I would love whatever she made, I would love. But so one time I was over and it was probably an odd time of day. It was like four or something. So between meals for them. And so I was there and everybody else was working outside or something. And so she said, "Hey, are you hungry? You want something?" I said, "Oh, you know, oh, it's okay. I can wait." She goes, "Well, I can make you some soup." And I said, "Oh, well, don't bother making it just for me." And she goes, "Well, you're as good a reason as anybody else." I'm like, "Okay,
nice.
I will let you make me some soup." So she was always, so she really showed her love through giving food, and she loved to talk to people, and she loved to laugh, but she would also say it like it is. So another time, I had not been there for 5 years. And I just didn't have time to get a haircut. You know, I just didn't make it.
I know.
So I showed up, and I know my hair is too long. Okay, so I show up at her doorstep. She hasn't seen me for 5 years. And the first thing she says before saying hello is, "Your hair is too long." Hello? Maybe say hello first. But she would always, like, if you gained a little weight, she'd tell you. You know, if you're wearing the wrong shoes, she'd tell you. You know what I mean? So she's very, you knew where you stood with her. So she was really, really great. And we were really fortunate that, you know, I got to see her quite a bit because I would go to the Basque Country a couple times as vacation with my parents as a kid. But I also went a lot for my research. So I saw her quite a bit. And she was able to come here a few times. And the last time that we saw her, she came with a son that lives with her. Her grandchildren paid for their parents and their grandmother to come here. I think they came for 3 weeks as kind of an anniversary present to the parents. And so she came along. So she was here. And at that same time, my father turned 85. So we had a big celebration where we saw a lot of people. So, I mean, it's still 5 years ago. And unfortunately, my sister and I had been planning to go this fall, in part to see her because we knew she wasn't doing all that well. So it was just sad to hear that she had passed away, but also she was so social. She just loved people, and the circumstances of her death was she was by herself. I mean, she was in a hospital and her family couldn't see her. And then the funeral was very Catholic, and usually they have a nice funeral mass and they couldn't have that for her. I mean, they sent the video and it was like six people that got to go and watch her be interned. And even her, one of her daughters, the one daughter that was with her a lot, couldn't go because she was in quarantine. She's fine, fortunately. But it was just really tough for her in particular to not have her last days be not surrounded by the family that she'd been surrounded by family her whole life. And so it was really sad that she was not surrounded by family when she passed away.
Most certainly. You said that even though there were only maybe a half a dozen people in attendance, people with masks,
right,
standing far apart, there was a video though, and this is what inspired you to write the lyrics.
Yeah.
And something that you mentioned in email, you wrote the lyrics to a tune already in existence. And this led to something, I'd say, kind of cool.
Yeah, so our Basque Club here in June, it's called Chino Basque Club, and we normally have every month we have a lunch, a fundraising lunch. But the last one we actually had was in February, and we had this duo come from the French Basque Country. And so the singer's name is Martin Larissa, and I think he's 22 tops, but he's a young man. And he came with a more established musician named Michel Ducot, who has been around for a long time. He's played with a lot of different bands and wonderful, wonderful musician, plays all kinds of instruments. So they came to sing because they had a CD. I mean, they brought like almost no CDs to sell, but they like to sing. So they kind of did a little tour and they went to the Basque clubs in California. I bought two and I'm like, "Wow, don't you have more?" But anyway, so Martin, his voice is just gorgeous. I mean, it's just very nuanced and beautiful. That's heartrending when I listen to him. So I had a CD in my car. There was one song in particular that I really liked the tune. Well, that was kind of like a fun tune. Like I should like write some of the words for that. So I've been kind of talking about it a little bit. And the tune that he wrote, the first part of it, it sounded like somebody was sneaking up on you. Like, here comes somebody, you know, to rob us or hurt us or whatever. And I remember it was April 5th because that was my brother's birthday. And I was coming home from hiking with my other sister, Padilla, and we had the song on. And so that song came on and we had been talking about, I should write something, you know, like a song about coronavirus. And that song came on. She said, how about this tune? And the first line fit exactly the first line of the tune, is the same meter. So then I went home and I just wrote the whole song to that tune because it just sort of came. It just kept going and it came. And then I wrote to Martin and I said, hey, can I borrow your tune? Because we were thinking of maybe putting it on the Chinabesco website as a sort of, here's, listen to this, you know, while things are shut down or whatever. And maybe, you know, recording it either with Noka or figuring something out. And instead, without my asking, he just wrote a whole other tune for it. And then he sang it. And he got Michelle to do guitar for it. And so it just sort of became a much bigger thing than I had anticipated. So I love the song, and I don't feel bad saying that because so much of it is what other people did to it.
Right. You can say that with all humility, since there were so many people, it wasn't just exactly your thing there. I'm David Fleming in conversation with Begonia Echevarria. You're listening to KVC Arts on 91.9 KVCR. We are streaming live at kvcrnews.org. Find many past KVC Arts programs via podcast through iTunes, NPR One, Spotify, and Google Play. And most past shows are at kvcrnews.org/arts. I see that with the passages written in English, right next to the corresponding passages in Basque, that the translation of Basque to English is different than what the transliteration would be. And so I have to ask, I suppose, when you wrote the song, were you thinking in Basque? That seems to be where the meter is and where the rhymes are, et cetera, et cetera.
No, I was thinking in Basque. Yeah, I guess it sort of makes sense, but I don't really write songs in English. I mean, I write joke songs in English. Okay. If you want to roast in English, I can do it. But the songs that I write, I always come in Basque.
Okay.
But I write other things in English. I write plays and scholarly things and novels in English, but songs always come to me in Basque. And part of it could be I've always heard it, and my father was very musical, and like his mother was very musical, but I think it's also I've heard it so much, and there are sort of standard meters that I think I just sort of gravitate to. In the past, I used to do more of that. I would take a song that I liked, and I would just write new words to a tune that I liked. So in some ways, this song is sort of getting back to some of the first songs that I wrote.
I suppose it would be much more direct if you were writing in English and then putting it into Basque, then you would have to change some of the words or some of the meter that would make it work.
And what I'm finding now is that there are songs that I wrote for the play, Picasso Presents Guernica, at the end. Actually, the tune that Belinda Tom wrote for me actually goes to both Basque and English lyrics. And so some songs, it works out that way, or I just changed it a little bit. But I guess I haven't tried it for other songs that I've sung with Noka, but sometimes it's pretty easy to do, but most of the time it's not.
Yes. When a person reads the lyrics, it doesn't seem directed at one particular person. Yes, this was written for your aunt, but were you trying to keep it more general so that it could be felt by more people, or is this just how you were thinking?
Yeah, that's a great question. I don't think I did it consciously. I mean, I had her in mind when I wrote it, and I think the place where I see her in particular is the line about, you know, we buried somebody without saying goodbye.
Yeah.
And I know that's been true for a lot of other people. So I think subconsciously, I guess I was thinking more of a sort of an example of what's happening to a lot of people.
Yeah.
And it's coronavirus now, but it could be so many other things in history or in the future. So I'm pretty sure I didn't set off to do that. It just sort of came out that way.
Yeah. Even at that point that you mentioned, we buried our friend without saying goodbye.
Yeah.
You don't even say our aunt or we buried her. You left a very blank slate for people.
Yeah.
And I think
that's
great.
Yeah. And I think part of that was because, I mean, she was my aunt, but she was so many other people's friend, you know? I think part of it was that, too. I don't think anybody that was there that was not a family member, but she was very well loved. So when they do have an opportunity to have a funeral, I would imagine it would be very well attended.
Nice.
So a lot of people really loved her.
Well, I would imagine that all the family by now has been able to hear this?
I think so. I mean, I sent it to some people. I sent it to the daughter, and she sent it to other people. So a lot of them have heard it, yeah.
Okay, well, then how about the rest of us? We heard it just a few minutes ago on this program, and, well, I have a copy. But for those listening, is this accessible anywhere? If anybody clicks on their computer or device, how can person get this?
That is a very good question, so I have to figure that out. But right now, not yet. However, I guess another thing that I should mention is as of yesterday, things are all set. So there is a filmmaker who wants to include the song in his documentary.
Oh.
About global creative responses to the coronavirus. So it'll be available that way, but it is available on the Chino Basque Club website. So you can click on it and see the words and all that. And that's chinobasqueclub.com, I believe. But we don't have it anywhere else yet.
I've been fortunate to have heard the Noka discs. and this one would fit right in. I mean, I don't speak the language, so as far as I know, it's another folk song. It has the same type of a feel, the same storytelling. You know, there's something being told in the background, even whether or not you know what it is.
Yeah, and there's a long history, and I'm sure we've talked about this in Basque and a lot of other cultures that were primarily transmitted orally, of people response to something happening, either something historical or personal. They would write a song about it. So I did send it to an ethnomusicologist, Judith Cohen, who was a curator for the Alan Lomax collection at the Library of Congress. And he had been in the Basque Country in the 50s. And I sent it to her and she goes, oh, it's just like all the Basque songs I write about historical events. Like, yeah,
hey,
I think so.
All right.
I mean, this is sort of what I end up writing. I either end up writing things that are very personal, like I wrote a couple songs about my mom, another one about my dad, or they end up being some event that is very personal. I'm sure that's not unusual. But this is inspired by my aunt. But as you said, it doesn't mention her name. It isn't specifically about the circumstances, but it sort of takes her as an example of a larger, unfortunately problematic phenomenon that a lot of us are experiencing.
Absolutely. And while you just mentioned it as a problematic phenomenon, and of course, yes, it is, another way that really I'm looking at this is that you wrote something very personal, and it was really, I suppose, for yourself and for your family initially. But what we have is something beautiful that can not only be enjoyed by many, but can be felt and related to by many.
Thank you. And while you were talking, I realized I haven't said her name, and I would like to say her name if you don't mind.
Oh, of course.
It's in the text that I send people, but especially because, like a lot of other cultures, there are a lot of women who do things in the background, and we never know their names, and we know the names of things that men do. But she was sort of a classic, you know, person who, you know, held things together, was a matriarch, and, you know, handed down the culture and language to her family. And her name was Maria Carmen Echeverria Itzia. They have the tradition throughout Spain of they don't change their name to their married name, so her last name is the same as mine because my father was her brother. And then Itzia was her mother's maiden name.
Begonia, thank you so much for sharing not this deeply personal event and story and song, but also the rest of your works. And it was great to have you on in the past in your various forms as author and as musician. And we look forward to having you again with your various projects coming up as well. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you so much for your interest. I really enjoy speaking to you and to sharing my various projects with your audience. Mil esker.
Amudioak deurua hiltzen baitu Egin behar duguna Naizta parte izan Elkar lagunduta maitatu Amudioak deurua hiltzen baitu Elkar lagunduta maitatu Amudioak deurua hiltzen baitu.
I've been speaking with Begonia Echeverria. We've been hearing about the song written for her aunt. You can hear the song through a link at chinobasqueclub.com, then click on the April 2020 newsletter. Again, chinobasqueclub.com. Wrap up another edition of KVC Arts. Thanks again to Begonia Echeverria, as well as to Teresa Ghilarducci, in conversation earlier with Emmanuel Rogers. Here at KVCR, thanks to Lillian Vasquez, Rick Dulock, and Shireen Awad. Music beds and themes heard on KVC Arts composed and performed by Sean Longstreet, so thanks to Sean as well. Many past shows can be found through iTunes, Spotify, NPR1, and Google Play, and most past shows are at kvcrnews.org/arts. Also, you can now tell your smart speaker to play KVCR. I'm David Fleming. Thanks especially to you for listening and for your support.